talking about today is the 5th century BC in Greece. It is the century which is usually referred to as the Golden Age, and as we'll see later, it's an age which saw the great dramatists, the beginnings of philosophy, art reaching very high points in general. And it is also the age when Athens becomes one of the great powers in Greece. As I told you before, Athens up to this time has not been one of the major powers. Corinth is a richer city. Sparta is far more important than Athens. The great cities on the Ionian coast of Asia Minor are all larger and wealthier than Athens. And Athens' start to greatness begins almost by chance. It begins because, of course, those great cities on the Ionian coast of Asia Minor, Ephesus, Smyrna, Miletus, and so on, had, you remember, been conquered by the king of Lydia. And they retained a certain amount of independence, but they still paid taxes or tribute to the king of Lydia. Then, when Lydia was conquered by the Persians, they became subject to the Persians. Now, those Greeks in those cities were typically Greek, in that while they were flourishing economically, and perhaps better than ever before, because they had a wider area in which to trade, nonetheless, they did not like being dependent on any other power. Greeks watched their independence above everything else. And the result was that when King Darius led that campaign against the Scythians, and you recall that was not a successful campaign at all, the Greek cities on the Ionian coast rose in rebellion against the Persian Empire. And they immediately asked cities over on mainland Greece to support them. Now, only two towns did, and one of them was Athens. Athens sent two ships to the support of the Greek rebels. Now, the Ionian rebellion was put down by Darius very summarily. It really didn't get very far, but he was aware that some wretched little upstart city-state somewhere had had the guts and the gall to send ships to the support of the rebels. And he was determined that they were going to be punished for such insolence. Now, he was encouraged in this by that Athenian tyrant, Hippias, who had been driven out of Athens, you recall, and had gone to the court of Persia. And the result of this is the beginning of the so-called Persian Wars. This is why Persia decided to attack Athens in particular. Now, any major struggle the Persians go on to required bringing together troops from various areas, gathering warships to transport troops. In other words, it's a large assembly pattern. And the result was that Athens knew well in advance that Persia was planning a war against them. So that Athens was able to prepare what it could for this, and it also sent a runner down to Sparta to ask the Spartans to send troops up to their support against the Persian attack. Now, the Spartans, in fact, agreed that they would send support up, but there was a small problem. There had been an eclipse of the moon, and this meant that it was a very bad omen, and the result was that the Spartans did not feel free to send their armies to the support of the Athenians until a good moon came along. So there's some dragging of the feet at this point. In the meantime, the Persians were not dragging their feet. The great fleet sailed, the Athenians kept contact with where it was coming, and they knew that it was landing on the other side of the peninsula from Athens proper, of that very small peninsula of Attica. So the Athenians got their troops together and shipped them off to the Bay of Marathon. This is 490 BC. There, the Athenians drew themselves up on low hills above a kind of sloping area that moves down into the sea. And remember that at this time all ships are beached on shingle beaches or sandy beaches. You don't require jetties or harbors or things of this nature. So the Athenians were lined up, hoping the Spartans would get there in time to help them. And the Persians disembarked at Marathon. Now, the Persians had a vastly larger group of soldiers. It's hard to know how many, because our historical accounts of this exaggerate numbers, obviously, to an extreme degree. Let us just say that it was a formidable group that the Persians started to disembark. And the Athenians charged from the hills against the Persians. And in actual fact, they beat the socks off the Persians. The Persians are driven straight back into the sea and to their ships and are forced to flee from Marathon. Now, just at the end of the Battle of Marathon, the Spartans came panting up, and all they could do was shake hands with the Athenians and say, "Good show, well done," and go home again. The Athenians, in fact, by forced march, went across the peninsula back to Athens, because the Persians had tried to go by ship around the peninsula, hoping to catch Athens unsupported. When they found the Athenian armies there, they simply sailed off and left. Now, this left Athens an extraordinary and an astonishing victor over a major Persian attack. And for the first time, Athens now became something of a great power. Now, the Athenians knew that this was not going to be the end of their problems with Persia. Persia was not about to give up this easily. And what did help the Athenians was the fact that Darius died, and his son Xerxes became the next king of kings. And as usual, when one Persian king succeeded to another, there were civil wars and rebellions that broke out in Persia. So that in fact, Athens had a period of 10 years in which to get ready for the next onslaught from the Persians. And in this time of difficulty, Athens sent people to the great temple at Delphi to ask what they could do about this. And the oracle at Delphi said, "Trust in your wooden walls." Now, that was a little unnerving, because Athens, of course, didn't have wooden walls. It had, sensibly enough, stone walls. And so there was a great deal of argument that went on in Athens as to what the hell Delphi was talking about one more time. Now, there were some people who decided that the Athenians should barricade themselves up on the Acropolis and with wooden gates. But Themistocles, who was a leader in Athens, said, "No, what this means is Athens must trust to its neighbor. These will be the wooden walls which will protect us." And at just this same time, in Africa, they had discovered very important silver mines, which were owned by the state. And all the money that came in from the silver mines was devoted to building a major Athenian fleet. And so they had 10 years in which to build up this fleet to get it ready for a Persian attack. And in the year 480, the Persian attack came. It was well advertised in advance. The Persians sent messengers around to the various city-states in Greece, demanding that they give to the messengers, as token of submission, earth and water. And most of the Greek city-states to the north simply caved in under this demand. Athens could not, and Sparta finally agreed to support Athens against the Persians. There was a fairly long argument that ensued here. The Spartans wanted to defend Greece, but they thought a nice spot would be the Isthmus of Corinth, which would, of course, preserve Sparta, all right, but which would abandon Athens totally. The Athenians, oddly enough, thought that was a punk idea. And so there were other discussions made. In the meantime, Xerxes gathered an extraordinary army. From all parts of his empire, they marched up across Asia Minor. They reached the Hellespont, where they built a bridge of boats to cross from Asia into Europe. The storm came and destroyed the bridge of boats. Now, that infuriated Xerxes, who Luke sent his soldiers down, whipped the sea with iron chains into submission. And in fact, they built another bridge of boats, and a properly submissive sea allowed them all to cross into Europe. Now that vast army then began marching across Thrace and down in Thessaly. If we are to believe the accounts, which we won't, they drank rivers dry in their passage. There were tens and hundreds of thousands in this vast Persian army. And it was decided to try to block it just north of the Athenian peninsula at a narrow pass by the seashore called Thermopylae. Now there were high mountains which rose in cliffs just from the edge of the sea. The sea has retreated some today, so there's a little more space. But it meant that the pass was very, very narrow between the water and the cliffs. And to hold this pass of Thermopylae, the Spartans sent a Spartan king named Leonidas and 300 Spartan soldiers. The Athenians had put all of their trust in their ships, and they sent their fleet out to try to block the Persian fleet from coming in to support the Persian army. Now, Thermopylae was an extraordinary experience because those 300 Spartans built a low wall, and indeed, when the Persian army attacked, only, of course, a few could attack at a time. So there were enormous flights of arrows that darkened the sky against the Spartans. And the Spartans, with a few others supporting them, held the pass. Now they held the pass through all the onslaughts of the first day, and they held the pass through all the onslaughts of the second day. And then a Greek traitor, a shepherd, contacted the Persians and showed the Persians another pass, difficult but through the mountains, by which they could bypass Thermopylae. As this happened, and on that final day of Thermopylae, the Persians, as usual, washed and dressed their long hair carefully, preparing for battle. They set off all supporting troops, but King Leonidas and 300 stayed there to hold the Persians back. They were, of course, attacked from behind as well as from front, and all 300, except one person, perished there at Thermopylae. They were buried under a mound which still stands at Thermopylae, and in fact, on top of it is a small Greek epitaph which says, "O stranger, if you pass here, return to Sparta and tell them that we lie here obedient to their orders." Now that was Spartans, that Spartan courage. This is the precise factor that made the Spartans so extraordinarily admired and revered by other Greeks. The Persians, however, had broken through. They marched on Athens, and the Athenians evacuated the city hopelessly. The citizens fled to islands, mainly to the little island of Salamis across the bay from Athens, and the Persians took the city of Athens and burned it, destroyed the temples on the Acropolis. A few Athenians rather foolishly tried to barricade themselves on the Acropolis with wooden gates. They perished. The rest, of course, were safe, and the Athenian fleet was safe. Now, Xerxes was with his troops occupying Athens. And the question now was going to be, of course, a sea battle. And here, indeed, in the rather narrow Bay of Salamis, the Greeks managed, by sending a false message, which was allowed to fall into the hands of the Persians, to get the Persians to sail into that narrow bay to give battle. Xerxes himself sat on the cliffs above the bay and watched the Battle of Salamis in 480. It was a battle in which the Persians were simply, totally, and absolutely defeated. The Athenians were victorious. There was, in fact, one of the groups supporting the Persians was a queen with her battleships from Halicarnassus. Xerxes thought, indeed, she was the bravest person present. Perhaps not quite so much so, because she was so determined to get the hell out of that narrow bay that she ran down Persian ships as well as Athenians, but she sure as hell got out, safe enough. Nonetheless, it was a Persian disaster. a total and complete Persian disaster. And as a result of this, in 480, Xerxes, his fleet, and part of the army retired back to Persia, leaving in Greece itself a fairly large Persian army. Now, that Persian army wintered in Greece, and the next summer, just remember that in this age, all wars are fought in the summer only. You only fight in good weather. You don't fight in bad weather, ever. It simplifies things. These are the ground rules. The next summer, the major battle was a land battle, and this was fought between the Spartan army and the Persian army at Plataea, which lies to the west of Athens. Here, the Spartans had lined up on the brow of a hill, and as you have already guessed, I think, from the eclipse of the moon, the Spartans tend to be a little on the superstitious side, as Greeks do in general, and to feel that they need good omens. Now, the great Persian army was massed in the plain below, and the Spartans up on the hilltop started looking for good omens, which included opening up chickens and geese and things like this and looking at their livers, and they kept slaughtering birds. And the Persians are starting to move, and the Spartans are saying nervously, how are the omens? Terrible. How are the omens? Awful. The Persians, they're awful. Don't do anything. They kept on not doing anything up here. More birds, livers. Dreadful situation. Finally, the Persians are already charging up the hill, and the omens change. Like that, and the Spartans attack, and they're so happy the omens have changed that they simply beat the living bejesus out of the Persians all over again. The Persians are driven right smash out of Greece, all the way up. They trek around through Asia Minor back toward home. Now, this is the last of the land battles of the Persian War. What happened after this was that Athens decided that she and allies should form a league to recover the independence of the Ionian cities from Persia, and to keep the Persians out of the Aegean Sea permanently, under attack. So they formed something called the Delian League. This was a league mainly of island cities and other city-states, and they swore that they would stay banded together against Persia under the rules of the Delian League until the bars of iron they threw into the sea would float. Very unlikely. Now, Sparta wanted no part of this. Sparta felt no longer threatened, so Sparta simply retired back to the home country and left the ongoing war to Athens and the Delian League. Now, the Delian League was set up this way. It would mainly be a matter of sea attacks against the Persians, and all members of the league had to send either ships with sailors or money, the equivalent of a campaign cost, to the Delian League. And with this, they managed to secure the freedom of the Ionian cities and to drive the Persians right out of the entire Aegean Sea. They even carried the attack down into the Mediterranean times beyond this. And this went on in one summer campaign after another. Now, the Delian League falls increasingly under the sway of Athens. It is sometimes called an Athenian empire, largely because Athens had the major fleet and kept control of it yearly, whereas more and more of the allied states preferred not to build ships or to send them out, but rather to send money payments. Now, this meant that the Athenians constantly kept a larger and larger fleet in full operating conditions, while the others did not. The Athenians took advantage of this, in fact, to more or less control the internal politics of the other members of the League, to make sure that they were democracies and not oligarchies, and they are again and again indeed subjected to Athenian pressure. Athens grew more and more wealthy, a greater and greater commercial state, and its allies did not continue to fare as well as did Athens. eventually, in fact, Athens simply moved the treasury of the league from Delos to Athens. This is the time when Pericles is the essential ruler of Athens. And what the Athenians did with that money was to rebuild the temples on the Acropolis. The Parthenon, the Erechtheum, the Propylaea, all of these are built with the monies of the Delian League. Now the members complained. This wasn't what they were paying for. And the Athenian response was quite simple. As long as we keep the fleet up and keep winning, shut up! It was, shall we say, somewhat arrogant. Nonetheless, this is the golden age of Athens. This is when its culture flourishes at its peak, when it is one of the most important states in the entire Greek world. And it is an age in which Athens waxed more and more arrogant. Now, this was bound to come to an end. More and more of these allied states began to feel the pressures and resent them. And they began to apply to Sparta for aid against insolent, arrogant allies. Even states that were not part of the Delian League began applying for support from Sparta because Athens was destroying their commerce. And the result of this was that Sparta, indeed, now joined in with states to try to punish Athens. This is the start of the famous Peloponnesian War. They start in 431 B.C. The golden age of Athens is a mighty short golden age, and it's sandwiched between those two wars. Now, Pericles is still the leader of Athens. What's more, in the period between the wars, Athens had built long walls, so-called, which connected the city of Athens with its harbor, the Piraeus. And this meant that no one could hope to ever capture Athens as long as Athens ruled the sea, because it could always bring food into the harbor area and hence could always man its walls and be safe. The Peloponnesian War begins as a somewhat, I hesitate to use the word about any war, but it comes as close to being an absurd war as you could hope to have, because you have the difficulty of a great land power waging war against a great sea power. Now, these don't result in battles, which makes for some difficulty. The Spartans came in and would simply raid Athenian territory. The farmers would flock inside the walls and inside the long walls for safety, and farms would be burned, crops would be destroyed. But it wasn't going to defeat Athens, and at the end of the summer, the Spartans returned home. In the meantime, the Athenian fleet is nattering away at the seacoast of Sparta, but doesn't have an army. So there's not exactly what you call a matched effect going on here. The first real trouble that comes up when plague is brought into the harbor of Piraeus on ships bringing grain, probably from Egypt. And we do not know precisely what that plague was, but possibly typhus. It meant that in this now overcrowded city, with all the farmers moved in from the countryside, the plague spread extremely rapidly throughout Athens and killed a very considerable number of the population of Athens. It is in the plague that Pericles himself dies, and it opens a period which becomes increasingly hysterical and rhetorical in the history of Athens. The Athenians begin slowly now to fall under the sway of demagogues, that is, people who get up and deliver impassioned speeches to the General Assembly about the war. Nobody can ever beat an Athenian. The Athenians can beat 10 Spartans any day in the week. We've got to get in there and pitch. This is what we need, is a little solid backing from the city, damn it. And off you go on this kind of demagoguery. There's always a peace party and a war party. The war party wins. In Sparta, there is a peace party and a war party. The war party is winning. So both cities put increased effort into this. The Spartans keep raiding. The Athenians come back. from all of this, with support from outsiders, both have support from other city-states, and they begin to try to capture Sparta. And in one point, a long sand spit of southern Greece, Athenian sailors finally capture, or rather bottle up, 100 Spartan soldiers, Spartan citizen soldiers, on this long sand spit. But they are unable to take them prisoner or to kill them. So it's a standoff at this point. Now this is outraging the people back in Athens, and particularly a man named Cleon, a son of a tanner, a tanner himself by trade, who got up and delivered great speeches to the effect that, oh, what the hell is wrong with this army of ours? Anybody could go down there and take care of a thing like this. And the Athenians say, fine, you go do it. So he does. He goes down there and, stunningly enough, takes one of those 100 Spartans prisoner of war. Now, this is an unheard of event. Spartan citizens always die, as you know. This is what they have to do rather than be taken prisoner. And here are 100 taken prisoner of war. It is notable that though thousands of other people have died, this is such a stunning event that Sparta immediately sues for peace. And indeed, both sides consider peace. But a war party comes up, and then they decide they won't go back to peace after all. The war parties continue, and finally in a battle up at the head of the Aegean Sea, in a major battle between Spartans and Athenians there, both leaders of the two war parties are killed. Now the result of this finally is that a truce is signed between Sparta and Athens, in which they simply return everything to where it was at the beginning of the war. And this is going to be a long truce. Now, this interrupts the middle of the Peloponnesian War. However, both sides are really revved up and gearing up for more trouble. There are more and more restless persons, and I will now give you something of a brief biography of one of the great Athenians of the period, a man who perhaps better than anyone else represents the shift away from worship of the polis to self-interest. In other words, a breakdown of character here. This is Alcibiades. Now, Alcibiades comes from the greatest family in Athens, the ill-fated house of the Alcmaeonidae. He is a nephew of Pericles himself. He is rich, and he is not only rich, he is also the most beautiful boy in all of Athens. Everyone adores Alcibiades. Alcibiades is flagrant even then. He wants to capture private attention. On one occasion, he goes around with a set of his bully boy friends. They break into a rich man's house. He's having a dinner party. They bust up the whole dinner party, steal things from the house, and so on. And the next day, of course, people suggest to the rich man that surely he will bring charges against Alcibiades. And he says, not at all. Alcibiades knows he can have anything in the world that I own and is welcome to. Well, it does pay to be beautiful, doesn't it? Indeed, he is a totally outrageous boy in every respect, and he grows more and more outrageous. And Athens continues to adore him. He grows up, and he's handsomer every single day. Everyone wants a part with Alcibiades, and I suspect a fair number of persons were getting it as well. He takes more and more of a position in public life, and in this period of the truce, there's an island of Melos, a little island which belonged to the Delian League, but which is in fact mainly allied by interest to Sparta. And they decided to withdraw from the Delian League, not to pay any more taxes to them. The Athenians, under Alcibiades, sent a fleet down to the island of Melos, and they captured it. And when they had captured the island of Melos, they killed off every man on the island and sold all the women and children into slavery. It was intended to be a lesson. This is a somewhat harsh view of the way Greeks of the Golden Age operated. This is the first exploit of Alcibiades. Then you have the situation that people from a town in Sicily sent messengers to Athens and suggested that Syracuse was a tyrant city and it was a rich city, and if the Athenians would bring them a navy and an army to support them, others would join them in a great attack on Syracuse. Now, in fact, the Athenians didn't know anything much about Syracuse, so they sent some people over to scout the situation. And the people came back and said, "Boy, is that a rich city?" Now, that charged the Athenians up. They decide immediately to send out a Sicilian expedition. The truce is still going on to Sparta. They'll send out a great army and a great fleet to this magnificent capture. And the fleet is placed under the charge of an older general, a superstitious one named Nicias, and the beautiful young Alcibiades, who is the darling of the entire nation. A perm, that is a column or a pillar, which is a fertility symbol. It has a head carved at the top and a rather large and prominent fertility symbol thrust out somewhere lower down. What happened when the Athenians got up in the morning was they find these carousers have smashed all of Athenian fertility in that night. They have busted off the symbols and smashed the heads on the urns, and it is, of course, sacrilege of the worst type. And everyone says quietly, "That Alcibiades, you know, no one else would do a thing like this. It's bound to be Alcibiades, totally impious." And no one is willing to charge him because the whole navy loves him. So the fleet sails with Alcibiades. Immediately when it is sailed, then they have a trial over this operation, and they decide to send a warship out to bring Alcibiades back for trial. Now, that warship catches up with the Athenian fleet when the Athenian fleet reaches southern Italy and puts in for water and food there. Alcibiades is told he must return for trial, and he agrees. He gets on board the ship, and they stop again down in the Peloponnesus, southern Greece, for water and food. And at this point, Alcibiades very coolly walks off the boat and walks right straight to Sparta and settles in Sparta. Now, the Athenians laugh like crazy about this when they hear it, because they say, of all persons to be in Sparta, Alcibiades loves good food, carrying on, talks like crazy all the time. Well, you're going to hate it there. They're going to ride him out of town. Not at all. Alcibiades becomes the most beloved person in Sparta. Everyone adores him. He becomes more Spartan than the Spartans. Yep. No, but a lot of charisma. And indeed, one of the Spartan kings has just been married, and just as he was carrying the bride over the threshold, there was a small earthquake. It was a very bad omen, so he abandoned his bride, in fact, and agreed to come back a year later and see her. Now, in the meantime, Alcibiades took up with the abandoned bride on the theory that it would be pretty sporting if he were able to father a Spartan king down there. And in fact, he does have a child by her, though the child never becomes a Spartan king, in fact. So he is still, let us say, getting on with his usual tricks. All right. Now, the Sicilian expedition becomes an incredible disaster. In the first place, the Syracusans gather more support and the Athenians less. What's more, the Athenians are under Nicias, who is old and superstitious, and the Spartans send advisors to Syracuse on the advice of Alcibiades. Eventually, indeed, what happens is that there is a major sea battle in the harbor of Syracuse in which the Athenian fleet is sunk. And after this, there is no escape for the Athenian army. Indeed, when they still could have got away, there was another unfortunate eclipse of the moon, and Nicias took it as a bad omen and wouldn't save it. The result was that the entire Athenian army was taken prisoner, they were thrown down into the rock quarries around Syracuse itself, the wounded, the dying, the healthy, all in the hot Sicilian sun. And eventually, those prisoners of war who did not die off were sold off into slavery. In other words, that entire Athenian navy and army perishes. Okay. Now, it is all of this which starts up again the next phase of the great Peloponnesian Wars between Sparta and Athens. This time, Alcibiades gives the advice to the Spartans that what they should do is to seize fortresses in Attica and to stay there through the winter so that the Athenians cannot get out to the farms ever again to raise crops or to support themselves. And this is done, and is done successfully. Alcibiades gives very good advice. He's a good war leader. On the other hand, Alcibiades is also encouraging the Spartans to raise a fleet. They've never had this, but they now are given money from Persia to help them to build a fleet and to man a fleet with sailors. So now the war goes into a deadlier phase. However, Alcibiades feels that he's wearing his welcome out in Sparta for one reason or another. So he now flees to the court of a Persian satrap in Asia Minor, where he is welcomed with giddy delight by everyone. He becomes the most Persian of the Persians. And there is indeed the golden boy all over again. This goes on until a time comes in Athens when the oligarchical party overthrows the democracy at a time the Athenian fleet is on the island of Samos. And at this crucial moment, Alcibiades decides for another cast. He goes straight to the fleet on Samos from Persia and offers to lead the Athenian fleet against the oligarchy in Athens and to restore the democracy. The fleet accepts him back as a savior instantly. He leads them against Athens. They overthrow the oligarchy. Alcibiades restores the democracy. The old charges against him are forgotten and forgiven. And he is now in charge of the Athenian war against Sparta. This is quite a man. Now, he takes charge of the fleet. And indeed, he beats the socks off the Spartans in one battle after another. He opens the sea route to the Black Sea, which is the great grain route, and indeed all seems to be swinging toward the Athenian side, which is doing well by now. On one fateful occasion, Alcibiades is away from the fleet, and he leaves orders that under no circumstances is the fleet to give battle in his absence. Nonetheless, in his absence, the fleet goes out and gives battle and is defeated. Now, Alcibiades knows that that is the end for him. Because, indeed, Athens had already, in its rising hysteria, formed a nasty habit of punishing by death all commanders who lose. They had, in fact, been doing rather poorly with commanders as a result of this till Alcibiades came along. So Alcibiades beats a fast retreat and goes up to family estates in Thrace into retirement. What happens, indeed, next is that an Athenian fleet gives battle to the Persians, and in this case, it's battle fought in stormy weather. There are losses on both sides, but the storm is such that the Athenian fleet does not pick up the drowned bodies of the Athenians who have drowned. Now, in classical Greece, you must be buried in earth if your soul is to rest easily. So that when the fleet got back to Athens, indeed, all of these people, the leaders, are condemned to death. One of them was Pericles' only surviving child, a son who was put to death. Athens is literally hysterical by this time in its response to everything. Sparta pretty much so also. Nonetheless, they keep going. And eventually, you reach a situation in 404 where you have in the Hellespont, which is a fairly narrow body of water, part of this series that leads from the Black Sea to the Aegean, you have an Athenian fleet and a Spartan fleet. Spartan fleet is down on the Asiatic coast, the Athenians on the European coast. And they're both fleets are beached. And what goes on is that every morning, the Athenians get up feeling fine, they shove their ships into the water, they get in, they man the oars, and they row up and down the Hellespont in front of the beached Persian fleet yelling chicken. The result of this is that after they have tired themselves out laughing and catcalling and carrying on, they then row back, beach their ship, settle down to have a little wine and beer and to laugh a lot about the entire thing. Now, it so happens, Alcibiades is living up on the hill above all this. And Alcibiades comes down and he says, "Now look, kid, why are you stupid? You're not even setting out any guards on watch. You're just all coming back and relaxing and paying no attention at all." And he said, "Now look, someday the Spartans are just going to row over in the afternoon and pow, you're gone." And the Athenians say, "Forget it. Yeah, you're a has-been. Back up the hill." So, indeed, that's exactly what happens. Alcibiades is quite right. One afternoon, the Spartans row across, catch the Athenians totally by surprise. Only two Athenian ships get away. The Athenians there are all slaughtered, and the ships are burned. What's more, the Spartans refuse to give burial to those Athenian dead. They are allowed simply to rot on the surface of the soil. Now, that's the end of Athens. It now has no fleet to save itself. It can be blockaded from the sea by the Spartan fleet. And indeed, the two ships that get away don't bother to stop at Athens to tell them about the disaster. They just get all the way away. And in fact, Athens is blockaded and is starved out. And in 404, Great Athens falls to this Spartan army. The Spartans take over, and there is, in fact, now raised the question of what shall be done by Sparta and its allies with defeated Athens. And all of the allies of Sparta say the same thing. Athens must be destroyed down to the ground, all its male population put to death, and women and children sold into slavery. Only Sparta saves Athens. Sparta counters this by saying, "In the Persian Wars, Athens did great duty and good duty for all of Greece and was our yoke fellow in these wars. It cannot be forgotten, and Athens must be allowed to survive as a result. Only that saves Athens." However, the Spartans put a garrison in on the Acropolis, and an oligarchy is installed as the Athenian government under Spartan overlordship, and that oligarchy proceeds ruthlessly to kill off all leading democrats in Athens. And there is a kind of bloody season. Democrats tend to flee out to the countryside and away. It is indeed the end of one of the most famous wars of Athenian history, written up by the father of history, Thucydides himself, who took part in it, and finished by another Athenian. I might add that a few years later, the Democrats come back in power, invading Athens and killing off the oligarchs, and will reestablish democracy. Nonetheless, for a while, Spartans tend to put garrisons in to all of those states that had aided Athens, and to establish oligarchies wherever they are in power. Only after a while will they begin to withdraw them. Perhaps the nastiest single element is that in return for that Persian financial support, Persia is allowed to have back the Greek cities of the Ionian coast. What the Persians could not win in war themselves, or what they lost in war themselves, they are able simply to buy back by having supported Sparta in the Peloponnesian War by money. It will teach the Persians a major lesson. Hereafter, they won't go to war. They'll just buy a Greek city-state and support it in their own interests. And this, indeed, is another one of the sure signs, in fact, that the old concept of the polis has given way, and the great days of this thought have ended up in everyone trying to get what he can best. Now, let me briefly finish off the golden Alcibiades for you. I hate to leave him being sent back to the mountaintop. I will remind you that he not only was the world's most beautiful boy, he was the world's handsomest man as an adult, and even when he became older, remained an absolutely dazzling and ravishing older man. Now, Thrace was also too hot for him. By now, Spartans didn't like him, Athenians didn't like him, the Persians didn't like him very much either. So he moved to a state over on the shores of the Black Sea. And there he settled down. To be more precise, he shacked up with a local girl of some beauty in a small hut out in the countryside. And while he was out there with her, he is attacked by persons in the middle of the night. And he rushes out from that hut. They set fire to him. He rushes out naked with his sword and is cut down and killed there. No one knows whether the persons that killed him were hired by Spartans, Persians, Athenians, or the girl's father. It's left up for grabs, and there vanishes from history the golden Alcibiades.